This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2018, held at Faith Builders on July 31 to August 3.
Good morning, everyone. It's not quite time to start, but I'm going to start anyway. There's enough to be said. I would like to begin with this timeline. This is a Reformation timeline, and there's a story to this. I used to have one of these. This was copyrighted in 1986. You notice it ends in 1975. I had it posted up on the wall for a number of years. So it rolled up, but it was kind of put on a paper that had some kind of special preparations that it got brittle. And so I discarded it. And I thought when I was having this class that I could go buy another one, and they're not to be found. I went to Goshen, Mennonite Historical Library, and asked them. We contacted Newton, Kansas, for Bethel College. They told me to check bookstores. There's none around anymore. And so if I had known how valuable mine was, I would have saved it or took better care of it. But there is one located in Beholt. If you walk in, there's one in the wall. It's the only one that I know of that's around. And so I took pictures of it. I was hoping to, by putting all these pictures, take it to some graphic artist person and get them to put all the pictures together to recreate one. That didn't work either. And so we did take a picture of the whole thing, and then we blew it up, and you can see how well you can read that. So I'm sorry that I don't have one of these. Now, here's the challenge. If any of you care about this, they were telling me that they're not available anymore. I told Beholt, somebody needs to redo this thing. I wish when they would redo it that they would go from 1975 maybe up to the year 2000. There's a lot of information that's still missing, and maybe that's why they're not reprinting it. But this particular timeline, you see all this little dark stuff up here? Those are all details down here, details that you can fill in. You can just stand here and study this thing. Okay, so they did come up with a follow-up, and I guess this explains why they don't want to reprint that one. This is what they have instead. There's pictures on that side, and it says timeline. And you turn it over here, and it's upside down. But the way it is now, this is secular events on the white side, and this is Anabaptist events on this side. And the significant Anabaptist events are in a lighter color. And so you do have quite a bit of information that was on there, on here. And this may be why they're not reprinting it, because this thing, 1500, 1600, 1700, 1800, 1900, 2000. So, unless, I still prefer that as far as the layout and the format. And so, I've talked to Beholt. If some of you live near Beholt and you put bugs in their ear, enough people ask for this thing, and somebody's brave enough, maybe Marcus Yoder or somebody could add to that and get the thing republished. So that's something I'm throwing out there as a possibility for you. Okay. Timelines are valuable because they put everything in perspective. We're going to look at a number of timelines this morning, but it's not really the timeline itself that we're focused on. As teachers, we're talking about real people who lived in real time. And so the question is, when did this person work in relation to this person and this person and this person? So I think that's the main point of our time this morning, to understand events in context with each other. Okay, I'd like to do a little review of what we had yesterday first. This brings us up to the Reformation. The first 100 years is the age of the apostles. And as I was telling you yesterday, with that course on Christian history, I asked the students to read in the Apostolic Fathers. They have to read all the Didache, they have to read some of the Shepherd of Hermas, and some of First Clement. And they have to write a paper of 2,000 words on this. And one of the reasons this is important is the way the early church thought is very different from the way we think. And it helps students to think about real issues in a different context. For example, the Didache is a church manual. It's the very earliest church manual there is, 100 AD, okay? This, my particular copy, has both the Greek and the English in it. I can't read the Greek, so that's of little use. But here's what's how it starts. There are two ways, one of life and one of death, and there's a great difference between the two ways. And then the rest of it has illustrations of how the two ways differ from each other. And for me, when I read this, it really settled a big issue in my mind. Maybe it's not a big issue for you. But some Christians baptize by immersion, some baptize by pouring, and in the past there's been a lot of arguing about that. Okay, listen to what the Didache says on this subject. But concerning baptism, thus shall you baptize. Having first recited all these things, baptize in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit in running water. But if thou hast not living water or running water, then baptize in other water. And if thou art not able to baptize in cold, then in warm. But if thou hast neither, then pour water on the head thrice in the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. But before the baptism, let him that baptizeth and him that is baptized fast, and any others also who are able, and thou shalt order him that is baptized to fast a day or two before. Period. That's the end. So what does that tell you?
The most important thing is that they got baptized and that their heart was really not obligated.
Exactly. And so all this arguing is a bunch of wasted energy. Now, I wish I'd have known that a long time ago. But it's right in this Didache. And there's a lot of other things. For example, it says, if somebody wants to come and preach for you and just hang around, if he stays more than 3 days, he's a false prophet. Because he's trying to live. He's sponging off of you. That's another practical thing that they give. And so you can check it out for yourself. All right. I'm going to get too hung up there. The second is the age of the church fathers. These are the people who followed the apostles. Like, Apostle John had a student by the name of Polycarp. And in Revelation, when it talks about to the star of the church of Sardis, that was Polycarp. It doesn't name him. Okay, then following them, we have people like Irenaeus and so on. Well, those men are called the church fathers. And then we have, going on to the 300s, there's persecutions. They were intense, they'd leave up, and they were more intense again, until finally they were relieved in 312. Whenever we have Constantine getting converted, we have the councils, the golden age of the Eastern Church, which is in Constantinople. It used to be Byzantium, and then Constantine moved over there and called it Constantinople from his name, and so on. And then we have the rise of Islam, Frankish Christianity, which has to do with Charlemagne, and what happens with him and his descendants, the Carolingian Renaissance, Slavic Christianity. Do you know that story? This belongs to yesterday, but I'll just tell a little bit. Vladimir was a heathen, a pagan, and he sent emissaries out. He wanted to test all these various religions to find out which one he should join. And so he sent people to visit the Roman Catholics. He sent people to visit the Eastern Orthodox. He sent people to visit the Jews. When they came back, here's what they said. The emissary said, the Roman Catholics were kind of sad, gloomy people. The Jews had all those ceremonies and all those laws to keep. That's not very interesting. But when we were in the Eastern Church in the Hagia Sophia over in Constantinople, we didn't know if we were in heaven or on earth. It was so wonderful. Well, of course, Vladimir decided he's going to be Eastern Orthodox. Well then, believe it or not, the Muslims overcame Eastern Orthodoxy. So how can that be? So then Moscow became the new center of the Orthodox people. We have the Russian Orthodox. So that was all free. And then the Great Schism, the East and West separated in 1054, I think the date was. Disagreements, we won't go there. Then the Crusades, we talked a little bit about that yesterday. Scholasticism has to do with the Thomas Aquinas and all this thinking about Aristotle and putting everything in little boxes. The schoolmen. And then we talked about the Age of Babylonian Captivity yesterday, and then Constantinople fell to the Turks. And then that's when it shifted up to the Russian Orthodox. Okay, so this is all pre-Reformation. Now let's go to this. Today we're talking about the Reformation timeline. And all we're going to be doing mostly is focusing on this side of things today. Breaking it down by 100-year periods, most of the things happened in the early part of the 1500s. Then we have Christianity expanding. In the 1700s, we have the Protestant revivals. In the 1800s, the gospel going to the ends of the earth. And in 1900s, the age of expectancy, what's next? Did you know that at the end of the 1800s, liberalism had come and people were expecting, there was so much development with technology, industry was improving, you have Thomas Edison and all these inventions, and the gospel was spreading. They thought, well, 1900s is going to be the day of glory where maybe Jesus will come in and take over. It's called postmillennialism. But then World War I happened and destroyed everything. There is no such thing as postmillennialism anymore. And 1900s have become the most destructive century in history. Now think about this. If my numbers are right, there is 169 million people died as a result of World War II. Soldier deaths and civilian deaths. Civilian deaths far outnumbered the soldier deaths. When you talk about atomic bombs just wiping out everything, and so men became scared of themselves, they have the opportunity to wipe everybody out. And then they started saying, we better get rid of these nuclear weapons. Oh, here we are, dawn of the third millennium. Are you folks encouraged, discouraged, or how are you feeling? Or don't you have feelings? You haven't thought about it. We live day by day, hour by hour.
Sometimes in my life, I think about how many drastic current events have happened that have changed not like the U.S. but the world in general. It's scary to think about your children and what they will, even just the change I've seen, what they will experience and the change that they will see, because it's only going to get worse.
Thank you. That's profound. Yes.
I look, and from my very limited perspective, I just see so much has changed so fast. It seems unsustainable. Either the end will have to come soon, or God will have to do something to just set humanity back again. Because it seems like, almost seems like the Tower of Babel has been undone.
Thank you. Thank you. That is also very profound. Now think about three Abrahams. Abraham in the Bible, and Abraham Lincoln. And then think about Abraham Lincoln and Abraham today. Abraham Lincoln and Abraham of the Bible had more in common than Abraham Lincoln and Abraham today. And that's only 150 years. And that illustrates what he's saying. Things are happening so fast. You know, in the Tower of Babel, God said, what shall restrain them in what they imagine to do? I'm going to go down and confuse their language. So will God do something similar again, or is time just about up? We don't know. But I do know this. There's an awful lot of hopelessness out there, and despair, and increasing suicide. And Jesus has given us a cultural commission in addition to the Great Commission. And the cultural commission is that we be salt and light. And we have that increasing opportunity. Do you know that just to walk into Walmart with your family of well-ordered little children and a wife that's veiled and modest, where did that come from? We go to 6th Street in Austin, Texas, which is University of Texas at Austin has 50,000 students. On every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night, they close down some streets in Austin for these students to do whatever they want to do. The only thing you can't do is get too drunk. You can't stand up. They'll haul you off. It is the closest thing to Sodom that I've ever been in. I was down there recently with a brother from church, and he had a sign. We just held a sign up. On one side, who owns you? On the other side, are you sure? And you don't have to seek out anybody to talk to. They will come and talk to you. Now, the last time we were there, it was summer break, so the students weren't around. But there are thousands and thousands of students, and they usually ridicule you. I wish I could take students down there just for the experience of being ridiculed. Last time it didn't ridicule us, but I remember one young man walking past us, just looking back at us and hollering, "I hate your Jesus." And when you talk to people like that, you might as well forget about your Bible. That Bible means nothing to them. But I can't get sidetracked there. Okay, so this is by every 100 years. And I don't want to read down all over this, but this is in the 100-year period from 1150 to 1811. I have some more of these, but that breaks it down into even smaller pieces. This is not original with me, but I want to at least throw this out to you. But there are pivot points in history every 500 years. We'll start with the flood. And back in those days, God talked with individuals, and most of the individuals rejected God. 500 years later, in 2000 BC, we have the Jewish family being instituted. And then that family multiplied in Egypt, and they finally had the Exodus. But the Jewish family basically rejected God. And then we have the period of the kings, David, 1000 BC, and the end of the kings was approximately 500 BC when they went into exile, and the Jewish nation also rejected God. And then Jesus comes on the scene. 500 years later, the Empire of Rome ends. There's some other things that are associated with 500, such as the beginning of the monastic movement. In the year 1000, the East and West divide. And in 1500, there was the Reformation. And here we are at the year 2000, and we have at least three simultaneous revolutions going on at the same time. You tell me, what's one of them? What was John just talking about? The technological revolution is happening. Okay? At the same time the technological revolution is happening, what other revolution is happening? Don't think too hard.
There's a constant political revolution.
Political revolution. Think Donald Trump. Has anybody seen anything like this? No. Where are we going politically? Do you know? I don't know. I started watching a circus 16 months before the election, and the circus hasn't ended yet. Okay? What's another revolution that's going on? It's a religious, moral revolution. Family is going out. The definition of marriage is what anymore? This is about gone. Does that matter long term? It matters big time. Because family has been the basic unit of society for thousands and thousands of years. Have any of you ever read Brave New World? The book Brave New World? You have?
Just part of it. Yeah.
Okay. I'm very careful about... It's a book that... Okay. Let me just tell you. This is a dystopia. 1984 was also a dystopia. It was a negative dystopia in that you've heard of Big Brother and communism and how it just constantly monitors everybody. Well, this is on the other side. This is what John was referring to this morning. This is where everybody is sick with pleasure. Everybody does whatever they want to. There is no such thing as marriage in here. Everybody belongs to everybody else, and all the babies are born through test tubes. And as the baby progresses, they have this incubator. It's on their own rows, and at certain times in the process, they inject a little bit of this, and a little bit of this later. And finally, the final product is certain individuals who are programmed to be the workers, and this kind of worker, and then another kind of people is programmed to be this. And the whole thing is happiness. And if there's anything that you're not happy about, you take a little bit of soma, which will make you happy. And part of this is two of these people want to take a trip to the set in London. They want to go to New Mexico to visit the savages. And the savages were people who had families. And this is, for the women, this is gross. A mother. Ew. They have viviparous. They're viviparous. In other words, females that have living young are called viviparous. And like some snakes are viviparous and some snakes lay eggs, they're not viviparous. And so to be a viviparous woman is... And I'm just giving you some of the plot. But when you come away from this, this man, amusing ourselves to death, says, 1984 is not where we're going. We're going this way. All right. So mankind rejects God. That's the end of that story. All right. Now let's just back up a little bit. I would like now to focus on our own story just a little bit. We are the Anabaptist people, and this Reformation thing is from our perspective. My guess is that everybody sitting in here would call yourselves Mennonite. Is that true? Why do you shake your head?
My church is non-denominational.
Okay, so what's the title? What's the name of your church?
Fulton Christian Fellowship. It's Anabaptist in doctrine.
Okay.
But it's not any denomination.
Okay. All right. From what I know of all of you except Brother Gertson, what's your last name?
Kreider.
Kreider. Okay, then you're with us. We're all Swiss brethren. We're not really Mennonite. Except him. He is the only Mennonite in here. Oh, yes, you. What's your last name? Yeah. We got two of them here that are real Mennonites. I actually work with Jacob Peters, who is a real live Mennonite. And there's a story behind this. I'm not sure if I want to take the time to tell you that story right now. Yeah, I will, since I brought it up. I should tell you. The Mennonite people are these people from Holland who took Menno Simon's name. Most of us have our roots in Switzerland. I actually come from a different place in Switzerland than some of you do. My background is in Zurich, and most of you, my guess is, come from Bern. Okay? Put the two groups together, we're Swiss brethren. Okay, we got in trouble with the Swiss authorities, and the Dutch Mennonites, your people, helped us. They appealed to the government and told them to behave and be nice, and they wouldn't listen. So we finally, Switzerland finally got us ejected out into the Palatinate. We were desperately poor. And then your people were very, very gracious to us. Since we were so poor, we couldn't even come to America, pay our fare. But you folks paid our fare and sent us off to America. Okay? In the process of all this, the Swiss authorities wanted to know what we believed. And we didn't have anything written. So we took your confession of faith, the Dortry Confession, and we showed the Swiss authorities this is what we believe. Except that we really didn't believe all that. There are things that the Dortry Confession says that we didn't really subscribe to. Okay, so if we have the Dortry Confession and we sign, our minister signed this, and this is what we believe, then we started to be called Mennonite. And it really helped that the Mennonites paid our way across. And so by the time we landed in America, yeah, we were called Menace, okay? But we were kind of an adopted Menace. The big gripe we had, the thing we just kind of smiled about, lifted our eyebrows, one up and one down, was on this whole thing of avoidance and shunning. The Swiss brethren did not believe that. It was just the communion table where people stayed back, not social Sunday. Okay? Now, that brings another point to this. Before we came across, after we were in the Palatinate, there was a man by the name of Jacob Ammann who got a hold of this Dortry Confession and started to say, and he was a first-generation convert. You can read all about this in Unserlein if you don't believe me. And he said, we say this is what we believe. Why aren't we doing it? For example, we didn't wash feet. The Dortry Confession says feet washing. Strict shunning. We're not doing it. We say we're doing it, but we're not. And Hans Reis, who was a Swiss Brethren leader, said, basically, those are innovations. And we're not about to start those things. And so they had some arguments, and they tried to call to some meetings, and it didn't work too well. And that was a long story there. And we finally separated. And our emotions were so high that in the process of coming to America, if the Amish discovered that some of the Swiss brethren were on the same boat going down the Rhine, they got off. That's how strongly they felt about that. But when they came to this country, the Amish people settled close to these Swiss brethren in Lancaster County. They didn't settle among them, they settled beside them. And today, most of us don't even know that we're Swiss Brethren, we're all Mennonite. And that, and the Dutch Mennonites, the Russian Mennonites, they're just a different version of Mennonites than we are. And I have to say, no. The Dutch Mennonites have a different concept of the church than what the Swiss Mennonites do. And I don't really want to go there, okay? That's all another subject. But it does bless me that a Gertsen and a Cornelsen shows up here. So a bunch of stuff has been bridged. And there's actually intermarriages between the two kinds now. Oh, wow, there's a bunch of rabbit trails we could go on.
Just a quick question. So there was no comprehensive Swiss Brethren statement of faith?
Except the Schleitheim that you have.
Well, but that's not exactly comprehensive.
Right. No, that's right.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
The Dutch people were more organized and more theological. And when they went to church, they went to admonition. They went to be admonished. When the Swiss Brethren went to church, they went to meeting. They went to fellowship and to hear the word preached and to whatever. Okay, I could really go funny places here, but I just don't want to. A few years ago, yes, Lester.
Another interesting thing about Jacob Ammann is that he introduced the communion twice a year.
Yes, twice a year. We used to only do it once. Thank you, Jacob. Appreciate that. You helped us.
And the reason for it, you know the reason.
Well, tell us.
Mr. Menon said, just at Easter time, Jacob Bauman said, there are too many women that are having a baby almost every year. They're missing too many communities because they stay home for a few months or so before the delivery and then afterwards. And so they miss communion year after year. Nobody has a baby twice a year. So if we have communion twice a year, they'll get there.
You know, Lester, I had actually heard that. A few years ago, my father and I and my son went to Holland on our way to Liberia, and I wanted to find the place where Dordrecht Confession was written. There's a Dordrecht city yet today. So we drove in our car to Dordrecht. And so I stopped the policeman and I said, could you tell me where the Dordrecht Mennonite Church is? I said, what? Mennonite. What's that? So I explained a little bit more. Oh, you mean Doopsgezinde. Oh, okay. So he said, just a minute, please. He got on his phone, called somebody at the university, and found out where this building was. He said, follow me. And so I followed him with his little car, and we showed up at a brick building. It's not ancient. It's not an antique. It looks like a modern building today. I'm sure it's not the original. And so I got to actually be at that place. But the whole point is, this is how the Dutch people are known today. They're not even known as Mennonites. Doopsgezinde means baptism-minded. Who are we? Well, from AD 33 to 621, we were heathen. And I just learned recently that my people who lived at Zurich were converted. They were Celtic people from the British Isles. They were converted by some early Roman missionaries. But then as Rome fell and everything disintegrated religiously and politically, we fell back into heathenism again. And then the German tribes came and we got intermixed with them. If you have dark brown hair like some of us, that's the Celtic side of things. If you have light hair, that's an evidence of the German side of things. But the two kinds of peoples are so genetically intermixed that in one family you can have dark hair and light hair people. Okay, so that's the heathen side. Now, with the Zurich people, we became Anabaptists in the 1500s, and Hans Landis was our minister. You might have heard about him. He was the man that the Swiss authorities had trouble with, and he wouldn't listen to them. They banished him, and they had a problem with him. So one day they decided, okay, let's just get rid of this. Let's just cut his head off. So they went to him. You can go. I looked in your library over here. It's in there. You can get the story and read it for yourself. And they said, all right, you have these problems with Hans. Yep, this is what I did. We're going to have to kill you. Okay, what do you want to say? The executioner said right before he cut his head off. He says, I don't have anything more to say. I've said everything I need to say. So he kneeled down and he chopped his head off. And that made a big fuss. But it was the last Anabaptist martyr in Europe. And from there they went to the Palatinate and soon over to United States. And Landis is still very much of a Swiss brethren name today. Okay, so if you're Amish in background, you do not carry that part of the story. If you have an Amish background, you remained 5.5 more generations the Catholic went from 621 to 1517. And here, you remained Reformed for 5.5 generations. And there was a man by the name of Ulrich Miller who went down and started preaching in Bern. And about 200 new surnames came in. And my guess is if you're a Yoder or a Troyer or a Hirschberger, any of those kinds of names, you came in about this time. And now we've only been as Anabaptist Amish or Mennonites for 12 generations since Christ. Very minor. We spend more time as Catholic or heathen than we have spent as Anabaptist. Yes?
I think a number of others came in even after that. I don't know my ancestor very well, but my mom's maiden name is Troyer. But I know the one ancestor we trace back to was Nicholas Kine, who only joined the Anabaptist movement in America in the 1700s.
Oh, yes. I'm half Rudolph. Rudolph is the same way.
Okay.
And there are various names like that. Yeah. All right. Now, we are just a part of a bigger story. I don't know if you can see all that, but let's just leave Anabaptism alone right now. And I don't want to spend a lot of time here, but I want you to be aware of Calvinism. When we talk about Calvinism, we're talking about Reformed theology. So who are these people? Well, the Baptists are a blend of Anabaptists and Calvinism. And that's a separate story. But of all the religious denominations out there, the Baptists have the closest story to ours. They actually claim Anabaptist roots, but I don't want to go there right now. Presbyterians. That's when we think of Calvinism, we think of Presbyterian or Dutch Reformed, the Continental Reformed churches. Okay? Congregationalism has to do with the Puritans who developed in England. Okay? They're usually more in the north. They're very liberal today. Okay, Anglicans down here. You know the story of Henry VIII and how this whole thing started? I better tell you. Henry VIII was the king of England, and the Protestant Reformation had begun. And he was married to Catherine of Aragon, and he had a daughter by her, but he wanted a son. And he wasn't getting a son. So he wanted to divorce Catherine and marry Anne Boleyn. And as you're a Catholic, you can't do that. But he had an archbishop who figured out a way that he could legally divorce Catherine and marry Anne. So he did, and he broke with the Roman Catholic Church to do that. And that's where Anglicanism was born. Well, Anne gave him a daughter, and he still wanted a son. So I think the daughter that he gave her was Mary, if I'm not mistaken. I should have reviewed that. But anyway, she fell out of his favor. He got her killed, and he married the next lady. I forget what her name was. But he finally got a son, and his name was Edward VI, and he only lived till he was 16. All that to say, that's how this got started right here. Okay, Puritanism actually grew out of that. But Puritanism adopted the theology of these people up here. They are not, Anglicanism is more Arminian. So there's some kind of strange stuff going on here. But anyway, out of Anglicanism, Methodism is born, the Plymouth Brethren is born. Lutheran is down here, that's the other mainstream, and Pietism, which is not a denomination, it's a kind of it's a reform movement. It can be within any denomination, but that comes out of Lutheranism. Okay, so we could spend quite a bit of time here, but do any have any questions before we move on? Okay, I have another one similar to this. I think we'll just skip over that. I think the next one is on the back of your handout. I try to decide which one to give you. I think this is the one, and it has quite a bit of information on it. I don't want to go over all the details on this, and you can use it for your reference. For those of you who, Lester, you need a handout. Did you want one, John Mark?
I don't have one either. I'm sorry.
Okay, give one to John Mark.
Okay, thank you.
Do you have any questions on this particular timeline?
You have some solid lines, but I was trying to figure out what they are. Are they just separation lines?
I think so.
Is this Elizabeth?
Okay. That's Elizabeth I. This is Henry's daughter.
I think that was Buckingham and Catherine Starr was married.
Okay, you might be right on that. Thank
That's
you. Thank you. Thank you for that. And Mary was Catholic. She's known as Bloody Mary. And Elizabeth was Protestant. Yeah. All right, anything else? Here's another one, and we could spend time on this, but in this particular one, it shows some places. When you do timelines, it's just time, but there's also place and geography in this as well. So when we think about Anabaptism, all we're thinking about is Switzerland and the South Germany and the Netherlands as birthplaces. That's all. I do want to look at this one. We spent time here earlier of looking at things that happened during the Dark Ages right here. Okay, now you'll notice in the Dark Ages, as time went on, Roman Catholic authority got stronger and stronger. But with the Reformation over here, Roman Catholicism got drastically weaker, and this thing ends about 1800, and Roman Catholicism power is continuing to diminish to this very day. The sex abuse scandals in the Roman Catholic Church has ruined and tarnished its image across the world. And actually, it was this corruption right here that helped set the Reformation in motion. Greed and corruption among church officials increases. And you'll notice here it says the Catholic Church takes steps to remove the Bible from the hands of the common people. Why? You tell me.
They won't understand it right.
That's what they said. Yeah. It takes a trained man to explain it. But what's the real reason?
Money.
Well, yeah, there's money involved in this whole thing. Okay. There's truth in there that they wanted to keep suppressed. That's right. But when the printing press happened in 1453, everything blew up. And people could read Bibles for themselves. And suddenly this stranglehold that they had was caught. And people began to read and say, this is a bunch of hokey pokey stuff you're doing. Yes?
It's interesting that Anabaptism was born out of a rebirth of the Bible. And some, a minority, but some sects of the Anabaptists are going back again and telling the people stop reading the Bible.
Exactly.
That's a circle back to Catholicism.
Exactly. They don't know it, but it is. Okay. I want to make this point. The Renaissance happened first. At the end of the class yesterday, we talked about humanism. Not the present day kind of humanism, but it was illustrated in art, where you have stylized art versus realistic art. Okay. When they move from stylized to realism, it's like we take an interest in the real person who lives in a real world with real issues. And the Bible speaks to real issues. And so it became more human. Okay, that did more than anything else to set the Reformation off. This is really complex. I'm just oversimplifying here. But out of that grew a desire for knowledge. Humans want to know. They don't want to be told. See, the Roman Catholic Church always insisted on telling people what to believe. But if you read the Bible for yourself, you discover. And since you discover, we say, well, if this is in the Bible, what else is out there? And they discovered the classic of Greek and Roman writings. And that's where you, when you think of the Renaissance, that's what you usually think of. Aristotle, Plato, all those men and their ideas coming to the floor. Well, along with that was a new interest in the Bible, and a man by the name of Erasmus, if I get time to talk to you, I'd like to introduce him today yet. He was a humanist. He was called the Prince of the Humanists. He is said to have laid the egg that Luther hatched. These ideas about checking things out and reading the story turned into a Reformation. Now, the interesting thing about that is Erasmus never left the Roman Catholic Church. He always stayed there. Luther admired him. Calvin admired him. Zwingli admired him. They took his ideas. After a while, Martin Luther had an issue with a man he used to admire, and he had no time for him. And some people say, I think Erasmus himself said, I hatched a hen, and Martin Luther hatched a game cock, a fighting rooster. Okay, one of the reasons why the Roman Catholicism did not want the Reformation is that if we don't tell you what to believe and we don't organize everything, the fabric of society will go into anarchy. And Lutheran movement, the Anglican movement, and the Calvinistic movement all had state church. Because nobody could understand how you could have any kind of society that would stay together unless you had a state church. It's only the Anabaptists said, church and state, the scripture do not teach that. And when Anabaptism was first persecuted, it was not persecuted as a religious movement. It was persecuted as a criminal. You're an anarchist. You're going to pull society's fabric apart. It's like warp and woof a fabric. Church, state. You know what happens if you pull the warp out of woof? Everything does fall apart. They couldn't fathom a society without it. And what's really, I think, really neat is that when William Penn opened up Pennsylvania, he said, all you persecuted peoples, come on over here. And they did. And there was no state church. There was a state church in New England. There was a state church in Virginia, but not in Pennsylvania. And lo and behold, somebody made the comment, we're like fish in the water swimming around past each other, and society is not falling apart. The impossible was happening. And when they went to write the American Constitution, enough of this freedom had happened that they actually put a church separated from the state in the Constitution and the First Amendment. I wish all Anabaptist young people who study history would know that their people paid the price for separation of church and state. That's a huge gift to mankind. Now, I know that it went through the Enlightenment. A lot of other people added to it. The framers of the Constitution did not look back in Anabaptist history and pick this idea and then put it in the Constitution. The French tried it with their French Revolution. There was a disaster there, but some ideas stayed. Okay. Now this is really getting up close. Luther was born in 1483, and Zwingli was born in 1484, 7 weeks after Martin Luther, those two men. Okay, Columbus sets sail in 1492 after, when they're boys, about 10-year-old boys. But I don't think they even knew that that happened. Because news didn't travel very fast. And that happened way down in Spain. Maybe some people in the higher levels might have known. But anyway, Zwingli finishes his education here. Here's Henry VIII and his reign over in England. But look, Luther posts his 95 theses about 1517, and so did Zwingli. Zwingli had the 65 theses. We only usually think about Martin Luther, his theses, but Zwingli had his. Diet of Worms, it looks like Diet of Worms. This is where Luther had to answer for himself before a civic council. And this is the place where he says, this is, the king was there, Charles V was there, and they asked Martin if this is his writing. He says, yep. And they said, are you willing to desist from that? He says, nope. He says, this is where I stand, so help me God. And with that, it's like that was the thunderbolt that broke Europe loose. It took a special kind of personality. The day before, he was asked the same question. He said, give me some time to think about it. And he thought about it overnight. When he was asked the next day, he was uncompromising. And the people sitting there were unprepared to hear something like that. The power was all present. And here was this little guy, Martin Luther, trembling in his boots, standing up to the power of Europe. But he did it. But it was so dangerous that Frederick the Wise, I showed you a picture of him yesterday, said, look, they're going to kill this guy. So he took him and hid him in his Wartburg castle. Martin Luther grew a beard and wore other kind of clothes so nobody would know. He even changed his name. He called himself George. So nobody would know who he was. And amazing, he sat in his room and translated the New Testament. He used Erasmus's Greek text and translated the New Testament into German. And I understand that that translation, I don't know if it's been updated, is still what the Amish people still use today. Okay, this is Zwingli's side of things. He almost died with the plague, but he did survive. They had these disputes with the Anabaptists over this time. Luther and Zwingli had a meeting here. Yes?
I thought the Anabaptism was started in 1525. In January of 1525.
Yeah, these are all before it actually starts. Before that baptism.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, they had three public debates right there. Now back to this one. The Roman Catholics are really, really picky about the sacraments. That's where you get grace. Okay, I don't want to go into all that. But it's called transubstantiation. When Luther comes along, he could not quite go with that. He said it's consubstantiation, where Christ is present. He's not actually in the wafer. When Zwingli comes along and says, none of those. It's just the memorial. That's where we as Anabaptists get it. And Luther said, that is false doctrine. I will break fellowship with you. Look at this. The next 2 years later, the Catholics and the Protestants had a battle near Zurich, the Battle of Kappel. And Zwingli went out to fight on the Protestant side. And there was a Catholic boy who was carrying the battle standard, the Catholic flag, and a young man by the name of Neff, whose family later became Anabaptist. They lived in our neck of the woods, our neighbors over in Zurich. He went over to that Catholic boy and with one slice chopped off his head. And Hans Huber, who was not Anabaptist yet either, who's going to be, grabbed that flag, put it in his shirt, and carried it with him. And it's in the museum in Zurich today. You can go see it. Now, Glenda Strickler is also one of my neighbors. The Stricklers, the Brubakers, and the Weavers, and the Bears, and the Landises, and the Fricks were all part of that. And the Hubers and the Baumans. It was just a little group of people where Hans Landis was our pastor. Okay? Did you finish it yet?
I copied it.
Okay. So I just discovered this just within the last half year, and Glendon here just discovered it yesterday. So it's really, really special. It's not just head knowledge and history. For me, it's so personal. It's like it's in our family. Okay, back to our story here. When Luther heard that Zwingli got killed, he said, good, serves him right. I don't expect to see the man in heaven. Tomorrow, we talk about Reformation leaders. I would like to share some things with you that are rather shocking about Martin Luther. Yeah, it took that kind of man to start the Reformation, but he was a character in his own right. Okay, 1534, Henry VIII declares himself the supreme head of the true church, except it's the Anglican instead of the Roman Catholic. And Luther, I didn't tell you about it, back in here, he decided he needs a wife. And of course, he was a priest, and he helped a bunch of ladies in a convent find wives. And there was a Catherine von Bora was left over. And he said, well, what about you? Well, who would you like? And she said, well, I wanted so-and-so, but he already got married to somebody else. But she said, you would do too. So, okay. So he married her. They had six children, and they had a happy marriage. She ran the farm, took care of the family and the chickens and everything. And in addition to his six children, they invited 11 other children into their home. And he would sit around the table and sing with these children and talk to them. And some people would take notes under the table. And the letters of Martin Luther, those stories are preserved today. You can read what he was talking about at his supper table. But anyway, there's a lot to say about Luther. He died when he was age 62. Okay, so from this period of time, an awful lot happened in the first half of the 1500s. Anybody want to ask any kind of questions there before we move on? Okay, I'm going to check you folks out. There's a problem with this one. There's something that's not true. Can you pick it out? Probably not fair for you. Okay. When it says Mennonite Church, see where it comes from? What did we say earlier? If this is the old Mennonite, this should be attached over here, not over here. Do you want to ask any questions about that at all?
Is it saying that the Amish came from the Swiss Brothers?
Yes, yes, yes. When they came across, there was no such thing as Old Order Amish. They were just Amish. Old Order Amish only has been alive and around for less than 150 years. Two-thirds, they had a division, it was a slow division over a period of about 12 years, where the change-minded Amish became a part of the Mennonite conferences and assimilated, you don't know who they are today. One-third of those people, 3,000 of them, became Old Order Amish. And everybody that's Old Order Amish today is from those original 3,000. And here's the amazing thing. Those original 3,000 are now over 300,000 in population. And the change-minded Amish have basically disappeared. There's a whole story there that we could talk about, but I don't think we should right now. If you want copies of any of this, I will make copies for you. Let me give you a few other things geography-wise. This does not include Anabaptists. That's basically showing where the Anglican areas are and the Calvinist areas and the Roman Catholic and the Lutheran. You notice the Lutheran is here. Part of Germany was Luther. I'm sorry, Luther, and the rest of Germany was Catholic. Geneva is right here. This is where John Calvin worked from. And a lot of his work turns into French Huguenots. My wife has Huguenot background. It's another illustration of other names who get involved in Anabaptist people. But here's Bern, and here's Zurich. That's how close they were there. Here's the spread of Calvinism and Lutheranism. Here's Wittenberg, where Martin Luther was, and Lutheranism spread south and north to Denmark, Sweden, Norway, and up this way. Calvinism spread this way to the east, down this way into here to the Apennines. This was always Catholic. And up to here to Scotland. John Knox in Scotland was Presbyterian. And Anabaptists now. The beginnings are down here in Switzerland. Here's Zurich, and here's Bern. If you're talking about Hutterites, and we are so blessed to have three Hutterite ladies here. I need to visit more with them. They're the third branch on here that they grow out of the South German, Swiss, our side of things. George Blaurock, that's where they're original, but they didn't really stay with us. They actually proselyted among us and got some of our people to become Hutterites. That's a story in itself. But they have continued down to the present. It's a huge story. Very interesting. Okay, but anyway. The blue here, I guess, is Lucifer. Yeah, Wartenberg. Anabaptism was in pockets. Here, 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 and here's the Alsace, which is on the French side of things. Palatinate is on both sides of the Rhine River here. So the Amish, I think, were more on this side of things. I'm not exactly sure where my family lived here. But this is the Rhine River, and this is where we got to come across, and this is where the Dutch Mennonites actually got us on board these boats and sent us across, right there. Anybody have any questions? We were able to pay our bill in 1922 when the Russian Mennonites were in distress in Ukraine. MCC was formed and we went over and saved several thousand of you folks and paid our bill. Okay, anything else you want to talk about? Look, I know we talked about so many things. The danger is, I just talk about little stuff on the surface, and there are stories under everything. But the job of teachers is to work himself out of a job, and there are books around, like Introduction to Mennonite History by Cornelius Dick is a very good place to start. Swiss Story of the Mennonites, a big thick book, fifth edition, is another good place. Cup and the Cross is another good place. Now, the Cup of the Cross and these others all tell both sides, the Dutch side of the story, as well as the Swiss-German side of the story. And even it would include some of the Hutterite story as well. Okay, thank you for your attention, you're excused.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.